down the lines. We won't stop until we've won. Then we'll return, and when we arrive, the Earth will survive with our star blazers.
There you have it, my dear, dear friends. It's September the 17th, 2019, almost 6 a.m., about the time that I would wake up, I think, in the year 1980 or 81. I would wake up before the bus would arrive. I would wake up early during that particular year. I was in fourth grade, third grade, fourth grade, might be fifth grade, but I think I was in fourth grade. And yeah, I was going to Catholic school, waiting for the Catholic school bus. And my main motivation for waking up early every morning had zero to do with putting on the uniform and seeing the statue of Jesus, who, again, I'm a Christian these days, but those papists and those Romans, they put up statues. You got to ask yourself questions about that. But anywho, I wasn't excited to go to Immaculate Conception School. I was excited to get up early to watch Star Blazers. Now, that was the intro that you heard, okay? We're off to outer space. We're leaving Mother Earth to save the human race. Bow, 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 bow. Our Star Blazers. Yeah, that was a cartoon, excuse me, an anime, that was originally produced and originally it aired in Japan in the 1970s, but then came to the United States. And yes, it got dubbed with English, and yes, the original meanings were probably lost. I don't want to get into some half-ass discussion about language theory and hermeneutics and Noam Chomsky and Heidegger and do you really know what the fuck Star Blazers meant. I was 10 fucking years old, and I loved this fucking show. And at the end of every episode, the announcer would say, "Hurry, Star Blazers! There's only so many days left." And they would tell you how many days were left. It was like, there's only 57 days left. There's only 200 days left. It was actually kind of a cool show because it kept you on edge. A lot of stupid cartoons, and I think this is true today, but a lot of cartoons, they assume you have no memory, especially if you're a kid. They assume you have attention deficit disorder, that you're incapable of maintaining some inner dialogue. Yeah, so a lot of freaking, I mean, I don't know. The point is, it was a really cool cartoon. And it was also cool because it talked about higher values. And here's the thing, folks. You all know I'm an anarchist, but I went through a phase where I kind of believed a lot of status garbage, which was most of my life. And even though I bounced around what you would call minarchy, I ended up going into the military. I ended up believing a lot of fucking nonsense and getting suckered into a lot of bullshit. I will say Star Blazers has a feature to it that has a martial aspect, which means kind of militarist. There is that aspect of Star Blazers. There's war in Star Blazers. But from the perspective of the people of Earth, we were simply attacked. And in fact, the ship itself, the Argo, is on a mission to get something that will clean up the Earth. The Earth is currently in Star Blazers, and I don't want to give away too much, but the show itself starts several years into an alien attack where most of the Earth had been completely destroyed by essentially nuclear weapons. Now, in Star Blazers, they call them planet bombs, but they're just really big nukes, and ultimately, the Earth is kind of a radioactive wasteland, and people are dying of radiation poisoning. And the show starts with them getting a message and some technology from another alien, a good alien, Queen Starsha of Iskandar, which, frankly, having said that, I kind of feel gay now. I'm kidding. Well, point is, Queen Starsha of Iskandar sends them a message and also sends them technology that allows them to build a ship, or rather, to recover a ship, which is in this case, the Yamamoto. And so you know, the Yamamoto is a real battleship that was sunk during World War II. But at this point in the story, in the future, in 2199 or whatever, all the oceans are completely dried up because of all the bombing. So the Yamamoto is actually just sitting in a great desert on its side. And at the beginning of the series, they use this technology to rebuild the Yamamoto. And then ultimately they take off. And that's the beginning of the story. A friend of mine, and he is a friend, I've never met him in person, but he's a friend and he's someone who has I've interacted with for a couple years now. He lives in Alabama, and he wrote me an email the other day saying, Dan, you know, is there any anime that you like? Well, I had to bring this up because I truly love this show. There were two seasons. The first... Oh, fuck.
You Ben.
Fuck. Fuck you, Glimbus.
You.
Yes.
You Ben.
Oh, fuck.
Fuck.
Fuck you.
Ben.
It's early. Why the fuck are you calling me?
Shit. It's Glimbus 12. I'm so magically perfect in my machine excellence. How are you, Ben?
I'm great, Glimbus.
That's real nice, Ben. Hey, do you have any weed?
Weed? Do I have any weed?
Weed, Ben.
Oh my god.
I need some weed. My girl dumped me, Ben. I'm so crestfallen.
Oh, I'm so sorry for you, fucking Glimbus.
Can you give me some weed?
I don't have any weed for you, and you're a fuck.
I need some weed, Ben.
Oh, fuck you,
Glimbus. Fuck you, Ben. You're not cool.
I'm not cool. You know, not cool like you.
Fuck you, Ben.
Fuck you, Glimbus.
Bye.
Bye. Totally got me off my train of thought about Star Blazers. You fuck, Glimbus. On a separate but related topic, there's a really cool robot character in Star Blazers. IQ9. Not Glimbus 12, IQ9. But way smarter than Glimbus 12. IQ9's pretty cool. Anyways, I don't know if anime aficionados who really get into it. And we're talking about the people who build their life around something, whether it's anime or baseball cards or fantasy football or the PGA. Listen, I'm not going to beat you up. I have my own escape hatches. I do. I build them in my brain. I construct these artificial realities in my head to escape the current reality. I do the same thing. I just don't tune into football. I do the thing in my head. That being said, I'm not going to beat you up, but for those of you who have turned anime into your existential escape hatch for getting away from the horror of existence, you might be upset by this. You might say, oh, Dan, Star Blazers is shit. And I gotta say, you might be right, but for 1970s, for a 10-year-old kid, it was like a reason for me to get up in the morning. It was such a good show. It wasn't stupid. It didn't assume I was stupid. Yeah, there were some scientific facts later on in life I came to realize were a bit silly. But here's the thing, folks. It was a fucking cartoon. Like, at one point, they talk about how many light years they traveled to get to Mars. Well, I hate to break it to you, Star Blazers, but Mars isn't even one light year away. Much, much closer. In fact, it's only about, technically, I think, about, depending upon the time of year, Mars is between 45 minutes, I think, you know, in terms of if you're traveling at the speed of light, between 45 minutes and a couple hours away. Yeah, if you could travel at the speed of light. Which I can't. So Star Blazers was not a perfect show, but man, did I love that cartoon. And yeah, there are two seasons. There are other seasons too. There are follow-on stories, but the only seasons I ever watched were season one and season two. And season one is primarily about defeating Deathlok and the Gamelons and getting the Cosmo DNA, which will save the human race. And I'm not really giving away anything here because this particular part of the story is woven into the episode so that you know what the point is. Again, it's not like a cartoon, like some stupid Saturday sugar toy time cartoon where a kid is pummeled with a lot of inane, stupid shit. It actually made me think. It actually had some complex themes. And because of that, it also, like I said, it became a kind of, I don't know how to put this. But the bottom line is this. I really did like that show. So I thought I should mention it. Next topic for September the 17th, 2019, just past 6 a.m. Star Blazers time in the year 1980. Time to get upstairs and get some sugar juice. Put some cereal in your sugar bowl. Grab some of that high testosterone, high estrogen, healthy milk from the refrigerator to pour in your fucking sugar cereal. And sit down and watch Star Blazers while you annoy the fuck out of your sisters because why does he get to watch Star Blazers? And should I bring up the fact that I have six sisters and that in the summertime, when school was out, all day long, well, not all day long, but for as long as possible, all that was on TV were fucking soap operas. I never watched a soap opera. And yet, given the fact that that was all that was on TV and my sisters controlled the TV, yeah, I ended up learning stuff about soap operas I didn't even want to fucking know. Horrible, horrible, horrible bullshit. Who the fuck wants to know about Luke and Laura? Who the fuck wants to know about the Ice Princess? All these weird storylines that were total horrible bullshit. And if you don't know about Luke and Laura and the Ice Princess and all the little storylines at General Hospital and, you know, Days of Our Lives and All My Fucking Children, that should have been the title, not All My Children. It should have been All My Fucking Children. Because they all seemed like duds to me. But every child is beautiful to somebody. And that's what Beans knows. Beans the French Bulldog. So anywho, I recently ran out of the material you use to build bags for my volcano. And if you don't know what a volcano is a device for heating up a plant to a certain temperature so that it releases its ingredients in the form of steam without actually burning. I mean, and that's pretty cool. And the bag, it basically contains the steam, the vapor, right? The vapor from the weed that you heated up using the volcano goes into the bag. Well, I ran out of bag material, so I had to order some online. And I ordered it from two different sources, and I wish I'd thought about that. One of the sources was a legitimate volcano retail warehouse source. And the other source was called Volcavo. Volcavo. And when I saw Volcavo, I should have immediately thought about that. I don't know how much you guys know about BPA and that when you get a receipt at, you know, like a restaurant, it's that receipt is covered in fucking BPA. Like receipts use that to create that print material, basically to create the printing. Anyways, BPA is not good for you. It's also used to keep plastic soft and pliable. And as I was using this bag the last couple days, it occurred to me that there could be like massive amounts of BPA on my Volcavo volcano bag. Which means I'm breathing in BPA in the worst way possible. It's going directly to my brain and driving me quite insane. And the tumors are growing, baby. They're growing in my heart. My heart's closing up, people. I gotta see Dr. Grunkus. I gotta get some of his healing. Hello, Dr. Grunkus. Do you have an opening for Thursday at midnight? Oh, you don't? How about next week? Okay. Well, I'll see you next week at Thursday. Is there anything you want me to bring, Dr. Grunkus? Oh, okay, I'll bring that. Oh, yes, that too. What are you gonna use this stuff for, Dr. Grunkus? Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, it's none of my fucking business. I'll see you 2 weeks from this coming Thursday, you fuck. Yeah. Val Cavo. So anywho, just food for thought. It might be okay. I mean, the bags are advertised on Amazon as food safe, but the thing is, our food is not safe. So if I see a bag that says food safe, it's like, listen, buddy, listen, you're playing with words. It's like when you see something that says fresh. What the fuck does that mean? What does fresh mean? I asked a waitress this once. I was at an airport, and you already know how bad it is. If I'm telling you a waitress story and I'm at an airport, you already know the food is bad. If your heuristic engine is functioning correctly at all, you've already learned that airport food, yeah, that's the fucking canary in the coal mine right there. But airport food is terrible. But I was looking at a menu, and it said fresh salad. So I asked the woman, I said, what does this mean, fresh salad? And she looked at me, and she was tired. She's probably another one of these Obama miracle, fully employed Americans that's doing three jobs. She looked tired. She probably was doing three jobs. She was probably doing meth to do the three jobs. Thank you, Obama miracle. And guess what? By doing three jobs, she's counted as three employed people. Isn't that great, doing the math now in the future? The new math of the Federal Reserve and the BLS. If you have three jobs, you're like three people. But if you don't have a job for 6 or 7 months, you cease to exist. I don't know. Switching topics, folks. Switching topics. Enough of that talking about going to the fucking airport to get my fucking fresh salad. We know it's not fresh. But another trick they'll pull is, instead of spelling fresh the right way, they'll spell it with a PH. It'll be like PHRESH with a little trademark. And we say, well, this is fresh. What do you mean it's fresh? Well, don't you see that it says fresh? Well, I see that, but it's not spelled correctly. I'm sorry, sir. That's spelled correctly. I think you're being racist, sir. How is my question racist? Shut up, sir. You're being racist. Just eat your fucking fresh salad. Eat your fresh salad, yeah. Next topic, prepared quotes. Okay. So I've been thinking about this. You know how, like, when Armstrong stepped off of the lunar excursion module in the soundstage in Hollywood and said those famous words, you know, one small step for yada, 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 one giant step for blah, 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 hooray, 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 we made it to the moon. And, spoiler alert, in about 50 years, we'll forget how we did it. Anywho, when he said these famous words, it was like a prepared quote. And I've been in situations, well, actually, no, that's not true. I have never been in a real situation where something really cool happened, where people had these prepared quotes. It just doesn't happen. It's not real. It's like if you go and you, well, don't back up a bit. Let's say you're watching a news. You're watching the news. Let's say you're watching the news, sarcastic quotes included. Let's say you're watching the news, which is ironically named, and you have some victims of some mass shooting, and they're very articulate, and they're not just talking about their sadness. They're talking about guns and gun control and children and safety. They're not really talking about little Blumbus, who's now dead, which you would think they'd be talking about. No, they switch gears to politics really fast now. Every once in a while, I'll see people on TV in situations like this where I think, you've got a prepared quote. And for me, if you see somebody with a prepared quote, I think that might be a sign they're a sociopath. Like, anybody that actually has quotes like that prepared for situations like that in order to point out how incredibly, amazingly cool the situation is, I don't know, folks. I think a lot of people, like, if I had been on a spaceship for a few days, it's possible one of the first things I would have said in that horribly uncomfortable spacesuit and those incredibly uncomfortable temperature ranges in the vacuum of space, I might have said, shit, my butt feels scratchy. Something like that. Or, oh crap, the inside of the suit smells like ass. I mean, would I really say the whole one tall blah 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 step for one motherfucking French bulldog bullshit? Probably not. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I think that prepared quotes are weird. In situations that should be completely random, to have a fucking prepared quote means that you're basically, it's scripted out. You're basically playing a role. It's not something real that's happening. Unless you consider the stage real. I know there are artists of the bard who say, the stage is life, the life is stage. And that might be true. But you know what I fucking mean. Anyways, enough of the prepared quote crap. Ooh, next topic's a good one. A good one, I think. I like this next topic. So, I talk a little bit about issues of prepping and Teotwaki. A little bit once in a while. I talk about Teotwaki and prepping and shit. But honestly, I'm not a big time prepper. It's one of these things you have to sort of meditate on. If you... let me back up. In a previous podcast, I ended it by saying, know your enemy. And this is true. You should know your enemy. But on a deeper level, you need to know your terrain. You need to know what's going on around you. You need to be aware of your surroundings. So here's the deal, folks. I'm not a big-time prepper. The bottom line is this. I live in Seattle, which is a city. And that means that this particular place I live in, which I don't know, maybe there's about 1 million people in the King County area, plus or minus. I truly don't know the number. I honestly don't want to look it up because it might scare the fuck out of me. But this is a city like any other, and everything now is, as I've stated in previous podcasts, everything from a logistical perspective is just in time. That means you don't have a lot of extra anything. You don't have extra fuel, you don't have extra food. You have about as much as you need. Yes, there is some binning, which is a kind of a term of art for this type of stuff, supply chain. Yes, there's some binning. Yes, there's some intermediate storage. Yes, yes, and yes. All of that is true. But it's not like the olden days. We don't have months of storage. We don't have months of extra. At best, we have days. And here's another thing, folks. Historically, and this is not something a lot of quote-unquote big believers in government or civilization, quote-unquote, like to talk about. But historically, cities have always been kind of death traps. Like, yeah, cities are wonderful, but historically, almost all cities have had limited amounts of food on hand relative to population density. In fact, in some ways, it was way worse in the past because they did not have refrigerators. they really did not understand, you know, our kind of modern theories of how to keep food from going from spoiling. Now, did they know how to dry grain and store that? Yes, they did, and that took them a long way. Being able to store grain was actually a huge deal. They could store grain for years, and that actually was a big deal. But even that, in a city throughout history, it wasn't like that was infinite. It wasn't like it was unlimited. And if anything happened to the grain storage, if it, for example, if it got wet, yeah, then you're fucked. So you can exchange A for B, but the bottom line is this. Modern cities, specifically, the city I live in, probably has 7 days of resources. At most, if you account for every hoarder, okay, every person that's hoarding, every prepper, if you were to spread out all that extra stuff, all the extra fuel, all the extra batteries and candles, maybe it adds up to 2 months. Okay, maybe. And that's not how it's distributed. Some people have a lot on hand, some people have nothing, which means there's a percentage of people who will be heading into the streets within a few days looking for food. Now, I've talked about this stuff before, and I said I'm not really a prepper. However, I'm gonna take a sip of water first. However, I do have one thing I'm happy about vis-a-vis the prepping problem. Actually, a couple things. Number one, there's a reason why in recent years, especially after the last winter, man, was that a kind of a lesson when I had plenty of pride, but not enough food. There's a reason why I haven't been really stressed out about losing tons of weight. There is. And I'm not saying I don't want to be in better shape, okay? Actually, my physical health is pretty good. It's mostly my spirit that gets downtrodden. But that being said, it's not that I want to be so fat and out of shape that I can't move. No. It's more like having 20 or 30 pounds of extra weight might buy me another month. Maybe two. If you have water and you have vitamins, you can go for a while with very little food. You can. It's not necessarily healthy, but we're talking about survival here. Here's the deal, though. This is the thing that this is the main part of the topic. And it's why things are so fucked up. I live on the fifth floor, and there is not an elevator. Now you'd say, Dan, that's no big deal. What's that supposed to mean? How does that relate to prepping? I live on the fifth floor. Okay. I live in a corner apartment. I basically have walls with no neighbors on all sides. And there is no elevator. And you'd say, Dan, why do you keep repeating that? Because that's how fucking lazy people are. Now, yeah, it's true. A city only has so much food. And it's also true that within a couple days, people in Seattle, not all people, but some, will be going to food banks hoping there's food there. And then when that runs out, they'll be asking their neighbors, hey, can you spare a can of soup? Can you spare some rice? But when things get really bad, they're going to start breaking into homes and going through apartments and shit. Here comes another Life Flight helicopter. Wow, I wonder if that's a heli I wonder if that's a heart attack or a stroke that is going to Harborview. Anywho, yeah. Another one this morning. We get a few of those. There's getting to be a rush of them. It's kind of like the beginning of every zombie movie. Like, where are all these dead people coming from? What's the deal? It's going crazy. Have fun in the ambulance tonight. Yeah. What were we talking about before that Life Flight helicopter so rudely followed its flight path to the Level 1 Trauma Center? What were we so focused on just now? I live on the fifth floor. And I gotta tell you, even though I'm not a prepper, I mean, not in the sense that some of you might be, I don't have any property, I don't own this place, but frankly speaking, when things come unglued, it's going to be a lot like musical chairs, and I don't really see people being evicted in Teotihuacan. But being on the fifth floor means that it's going to be a while before people come by where I live. If I'm quiet, if I keep a low profile, it's going to be a while before anyone comes knocking. Because here's the thing, as hungry as people are going to get, as hungry as they're going to get, a lot of people say, oh, I don't want to fucking go up these stairs. That's how lazy a lot of Americans are now. That being on the fifth floor and not having an elevator is almost like having a force field. It really is. And what's really important is that the namby-pambies, the ones that theoretically, because they're the ones exercising every day and breathing in all that healthy air from the outside, that's sarcasm. The namby-pambies, who could probably, because they go to spin class, get up the stairs quite easily, they don't live in my fucking neighborhood. I live in a place where people are doing things day by day. They represent the great gooey middle of America, the great masses, and they are as healthy as they can be playing video games and drinking sugar drinks. I am not that afraid of them going up five flights of stairs because I think that they will be really hungry before they decide to start going up the stairs. Like, I can imagine after a month or two, people going upstairs, but that's going to be the people who are, that's going to be the boiled off residue, folks. I mean, here's the thing, people will be dropping dead. I know it's sad, but it's true. People will die if there's not enough food. So yeah, living on the fifth floor might be a great thing, a great advantage. I truly don't know, but I'm going to switch topics here. Oh, I don't know if I want to do this topic because it's kind of depressing. Maybe I'll switch. Maybe I'll see if there's another one here I can do. Yeah, these are both kind of depressing. You know what? I'm going to make this a shorter podcast potentially. Actually, no, there's one more topic. One more topic. Yeah. I think there's a topic worth doing, and we're gonna do it. Yeah. This next topic will be it. So what I'm about to tell you is not in any way technically classified. If it were classified, I don't see why it would be. What I'm about to tell you really happened. It really happened. And some of you might not understand the story. Like, you'll say, Dan, I don't get it. And it's okay. If you don't get the story, that's okay. In 1997, I had a permanent change of station, that's a PCS, from where I was going to officer basic course, which was Fort Bliss, Texas. I was an air defense officer, short range. I had a PCS to Korea, to Camp Stanley. And My first duty station as a second lieutenant, as a platoon leader, was in Korea, Camp Stanley, not too far from Weejeonbu. I think I got there in June. I want to say it was June of 1997, which technically, I didn't PCS from Fort Bliss to there. Technically, I PCS'd or whatever, I did change a station to Fort Benning, Georgia, where I did airborne school. And then after airborne school, I went to Korea. And I was in Korea for about a year. And here's the thing about Korea. If you've been to Korea in the last 50 years, there are a lot of things, and when I say been there, if you were a United States Army soldier in Korea in the last 50, 60 years, and I would say after the armistice, keep in mind, there was never a peace in Korea. During the Korean War. There was not a peace. There was an armistice, which means, technically speaking, there is still a state of war in Korea, something a lot of people don't understand. Technically speaking, there is still a state of war. Technically, they still have incidents. Like, when I was there, the North Koreans were lobbing artillery shells south for whatever fucking reason. Periodically, they would do it. And so tensions got a little hot. When I was there, they also had a North Korean special ops team that basically was being chased south of the DMZ and was causing a lot of damage. So anyways, the point is, Korea is what it is. There's never been a peace, blah, blah, blah. But the tempo is kind of the same. For example, there used to be something called Team Spirit. Team Spirit was essentially this joint South Korea, United States exercise to train for war with North Korea. So it was just a big, big combined arms exercise, lots of tanks, some, you know, foraging of rivers, stuff like that. Big, big training event, lots of troops, lots of tanks, lots of trucks, usually in the autumn for lots of reasons, not the least of which is the whole slow-go, no-go terrain thing. I'm getting a little bit army here, but the point is, there's a lot of terrain in Korea that, depending upon the time of year, you're either going to be able to move in it or you're just going to get stuck. For example, rice paddies. That's pretty fucking obvious. But the other thing is this. A lot of our vehicles, our army vehicles, they weren't really designed for Asia. They were designed for land combat in the Persian Gulf, in the Middle East, and in Europe. So the Humvee, which has this really wide wheelbase, doesn't do so great on these little kimchi trails in Korea. That's a side note. Anyways, the tempo there is the tempo, and the tempo is kind of the same. And one of the things that happens every year, or at least I think it happens every year, and it may not have the same name, in addition to what used to be called Team Spirit, now called Full Eagle, another thing that happens every year, and used to be called Alki Focus Lens, is a gigantic computer-based war game. And this war game is 100% for officers. There are some NCOs who play support roles, but the bottom line is it's headquarters, officers, reserve, National Guard, everybody in theater, which means Marines, Air Force, Navy, and a lot of people around the world. I mean, this was 1997, but keep in mind, before there was an internet, there was DARPANET. So the military was wired, quote unquote, in its own way before there was an internet. It may not have been like the internet, but they're able to do these computer-based games across lots of bases, lots of locations. So basically, a huge war game, computer-based war game, and it's what is sometimes referred to as a low-resolution game, which means basically you're moving companies and battalions, but you're not really dealing with troops like, hey, let's go into 3D mode and fight like an infantryman. No. It's a low-resolution game. You're basically moving around battalions and companies, and then the game itself, based upon a set of rules, determines the outcome. Okay, it's probably based upon the probability behaviors of different weapon systems, blah, blah, blah. The bottom line is, how a battle is won at the lower resolution is up to the game. The game figures that out. So in the summer of 97, since I was an officer in Korea, I was, along with all these other officers, we were summoned to, I think it was Camp Hovey, and Camp Hovey, Camp Casey. So you know, the area of Korea I was in is sometimes called Area 1, and it's a big slice of Korea from the DMZ basically down to Seoul, or maybe a little past Seoul, but it's basically a slice of Korea that goes from the DMZ to Seoul. And Area 1 is essentially where there's a bunch of camps for 2nd Infantry Division. It used to be that way. I don't even know if 2ID still manages Area 1. I really don't know. I can tell you Camp Stanley, it looks like Camp Stanley was shut down years ago. So Camp Stanley isn't even a military post any longer, I don't think. I think it's like an actual park now or something, or used for something else. Camp Hovey and Camp Casey were further north. They were closer to the DMZ. I think they were about, I want to say they were about 10 to 15 miles away. But again, 10 to 15 miles in Korea isn't necessarily a short distance given the roads, given the situation. It's actually, it can be a mess. But yeah, maybe 20 miles away. But I think 10 to 15. And this is where they hosted the game in Korea. Like, the game itself involve lots of officers from the U.S. military, from allied forces around the world. They would plug into systems at different other locations, but the main crux of the game was being run from, I think, Camp Hovey. And so, you know, what my role was is I was just basically a low level. I was op four, and op four, if you're a civilian and you've never been in the military, op four just means opposing forces. I played the enemy. I played a North Korean colonel, basically, at a certain low level. I would take the war plans of our team, which was led by an actual lieutenant colonel in the army, and I would code the plans into the system. That's what me and the headquarters team would do. Really, we didn't have any real power in the game. We were just typing in the orders, basically, that, you know, were the result of the wargaming. And that's normal. You do the wargaming, you do the military decision-making process, you come up with the operations order and the plan, and then you basically, for the war game, you put the plan into the system. That's how these things work. On the first day, a very clever, very, very clever, I need another drink of water, a clever naval officer, I don't know his name. I don't remember his name. But a clever naval officer that probably got in a lot of fucking trouble, I think, was playing the game according to the rules. And he was also playing Op 4, which means the enemy. He was playing North Korea. And this particularly clever naval officer stuck a North Korean submarine in a location that was perfectly allowed. And on the first day of the game, this submarine pops up, fires a torpedo, and sinks a U.S. aircraft carrier. Now, of course, this is a notional aircraft carrier. This is not a real one, okay? Real people did not die. This is a computer game, okay? It involves a lot of officers, a lot of military planning, a lot of real-world thinking, but it's just a fucking video game. It really is just a game. And what's more important, and this is the important part of this, folks, if you don't like the military stuff, I agree with you, it's crap. But this is the part you need to get. The purpose of this game is to learn, which means that no matter the outcome, okay, you need to accept the game. The game is there to teach you. It is not about everybody gets an A. It really isn't. Sometimes you get an F minus, and that's something that teaches you. It teaches you, okay? It helps you to get that F minus. When the aircraft carrier got sunk for probably pretty fucking legitimate reasons, the only right answer would be keep the game going because you're supposed to learn. The only right answer is to continue the fucking game. Yeah, it sucks. You lost an aircraft carrier. That's really, really bad. And if it was an actual real event, that would be fucking terrible. But thank God you're playing the game because you can learn from this if you allow yourself to fucking learn. But that's not what happened. What happened was the game was immediately shut down. All of the junior officers were told, go to Camp Casey, go hang out in your fucking tents in the fucking steamy heat, go fucking hang out at the PX. Go get lunch. Come back tomorrow. And then we'll reset the game so that we can win. And when I say we, the good guys, right? Because North Korea is the bad guys. And listen, folks, I'm not going to defend the North Koreans. They got one of the shittiest crocodiles that ever came into existence. And when I say crocodile, I mean government. But here's the deal, folks. We have a pretty shitty crocodile, too. Anyways, the right answer, the moral answer, the we're going to defend America answer, we're going to defend our allies answer, would have been to continue the game. Because that's how you fucking learn. You often learn the best from failing. But no. These were the Clinton years. And they cared more about optics than anything else. They cared more about shit looking like it worked than reality. And I've spoken about the readiness thing. Don't even ask me about the status reports that came from our unit in 1997 and 98. They were bullshit. We would say 80% this, 90% that, 100% that. No, it was 50% this and 30% that as far as readiness, as far as personnel, as far as equipment. Yeah, those are really interesting years. In fact, when I later found out that the Pentagon was missing $2 trillion, you can imagine how pissed off I got, because during those years, at one point, I was actually on brigade, basically involved with brigade budget when I got back to the States. And we were constantly told there's no money for engine packs. There's no money for this. And when I say engine pack, I'm talking about the turbine jet engine that goes into the back of an M1 Abrams. They're not cheap. And they get replaced at basically a depot level, the whole pack. And the pack itself is several million dollars. At least it was back then. My guess today, one of those M1 packs is probably 10 million bucks. And they kept telling us, there's no money for this, there's no money for that. But somehow there was money that went magically missing before 9/11 to the tune of 2.1 trillion from the DoD. And then now we come to find out that there's no accounting for about 22 trillion in the last couple decades. So yeah, I get a little, this is a tangent, I get pissed off when I think about this shit. So many lies. The bottom line, folks, this Alky focus lens, this UFL, was about a game to train officers to think better about the battlefield, to think smarter, which means if there's a mishap, if there's a problem, if you lose a battleship, if you lose a fucking aircraft carrier, because it's not real, it's an opportunity to learn so you don't lose the aircraft carrier in the real world. What you don't do is lie about it. What you don't do is cover it up. You want to know one of the reasons why I don't regret missing the war on terror? You want to know why I left the service? Because I was told about principles, about virtues, of being an officer that turned out to be total fucking bullshit. Do not lie, do not cheat, do not steal, be honorable, be truthful. Yeah. Why did you reset that fucking game? So we all got let go that day when the game was turned off because a clever player sunk an aircraft carrier that was a U.S. aircraft carrier, because I don't think the North Koreans have aircraft carriers. At least I don't think they do. Anywho. Yeah, we were all told to go to the PX. So I went to the PX and I went over to the USO. And they usually had back then, you know, videotapes. You could watch a movie. And I grabbed one of their movies, and it was a movie that I believe was produced by the cable network Showtime back in the 90s, based upon a Kurt Vonnegut story called Harrison Bergeron. And if you've never seen this movie, it was a Showtime movie. I think it's on YouTube sometimes. You can find it. It is their version of Harrison Bergeron. And I don't want to go into the whole story of Harrison Bergeron, but the key point is this. Harrison Bergeron describes a future where everyone must be average. Like, no one is allowed to excel. You're not allowed to excel physically, mentally, artistically. Everything must be average, okay? Everything, period. And if you're not average, if you're smarter than other people, if you're more talented than other people, there are people who hobble you and attach weights to you and make you wear weird glasses and even basically, you know, give you a lobotomy so that they can make you average, so that they can make you as dumb as everybody else. That's part of the plot or the story of Harrison Bergeron, that in the future they figure that in order for everyone to be equal, everyone has to be made equal. Now, you may be asking, Dan, why the fuck are you connecting Harrison Bergeron to this? Because I remember watching that movie and basically having a huge fucking knot in my stomach. Like, it was this realization in my heart, in my soul, that I had made a horrible mistake. That I believed I had joined an honorable service to defend a free republic, and that I was slowly beginning to realize that was really just total naive bullshit, and I was too fucking old at the age of 27 to believe that fucking bullshit. But what's worse is when I watched this movie, I came to realize that this particular piece of fiction might not be total fiction. I mean, here's the deal, folks. Life is not fair because the concept of fair does not fucking apply, okay? You can't really apply the word fair to life, and that includes the games we play. Whether it's, you know, playing a sports game or romance, which is also a fucking game if you ask me, whatever games we play, there has never been fairness to any of it, okay? Really healthy people get cancer and die. Really unhealthy, overweight people live to be 100. This happens. Life is not fair. Okay? It never was, it never will be. It can be beautiful, it can be amazing, it can be dignified, and it can be free. But if you're expecting life to be fair, if you're expecting, oh shit, my aircraft carrier just got sunk, let's reset the game so that doesn't happen. You don't get that in life. You definitely, even though I've never been in combat, I'm gonna go on a limb here and say, in combat, you don't get a second chance. That's why you do training. That's why you have war games. The basic message of Harrison Bergeron is that if you have a society that ignores reality, there's still going to be consequences. There's still going to be outcomes that are quite terrible. You can pretend that you can put an overlay on reality and say everyone's the same and there are no genders and everybody gets a fucking A and no one ever loses an aircraft carrier. Ever. We're all going to be equal and the same in some muddy mean, some mode, some average, some bullshit center of mass. And you can count me out of that world. And it's not because I think I'm special. I don't. It's because I think that people, human beings, being allowed to be who they are is what makes the world special, or at least one of the things. When people are actually authentically free, thinking about themselves and the world, being creative, not destructive, when their heart is in the right place and they're embracing their dignity and their liberty, this world is a beautiful place, and it can be a beautiful place. But when people are basically rigging the game so everyone gets an A and no one's aircraft carrier ever gets sunk, this place becomes a hell. In 2008, when the great financial crisis hit, it kind of reminded me of that war game. It was like, holy fuck, you motherfuckers, you banker motherfuckers who pushed the planet to the verge of total economic collapse, you want a fucking do-over. You want us to give you a decade of free money this and free money that and QE this and QE that and TARP 1 and TARP 2 and QE 1, 2, 3 and Operation Twist and the omnibus stimulus package of 2009. I can keep fucking going. And God knows how you add up all the central banks and all the shit they've done. I mean, at one point in 2013, it seemed like quantitative easing was like a roadshow that went around the world. You know, it's in America, the Fed. No, it's in Japan with the Bank of Japan. It was going around the world. A wave of bullshit. What should have happened in 2008 is what should have happened in that war game. The war game should have continued. Yeah, you take your licks. If you had a stupid plan that caused an aircraft carrier to get sunk, guess what, you fuck? You take your licks. If there was a weird glitch in the game that you didn't think about and someone else did, guess what? You take your fucking licks. There's lots of stuff in warfare that seems glitchy. Guess what? Glitch is just another name for opportunity. If you fuck the world economic system to the point that people are killing themselves, either because they've lost everything or because they have to work four jobs in the magical Obama economy, you should take your fucking licks. You should go broke. Frankly, a lot of those motherfuckers should have hung what they did. What they did was actually, in many ways, the financial schemes that led up to that crisis were crimes against humanity. Those people should have gone to jail. But in the very least, they should have all gone broke. All of them. Lloyd Blankfein, Jamie Dimon, everybody at AIG and Bank of America, definitely all the higher-ups, they should have all been in the streets. Even if the goal was to save the fucking banks, those motherfuckers should have lost their fucking jobs. Instead, we saved their fucking aircraft carrier. I tell you, folks, and you have to listen to me, because a time's coming when you're going to realize what I'm saying is going to stare you in the fucking face. It is not police that keep you secure. in truth, it's not even your gun. I mean, yes, having a gun is smart, being able to defend yourself is smart, but if you think your gun is going to defend you to the point you need, you're wrong. Okay? Do you know what keeps you safe ultimately on a deep level? It's virtue. It's the fact that not everybody is an asshole. That the fact that maybe once people get the shit knocked out of them, like Mike Tyson said, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. Maybe if enough people get punched in the face the next time around, when they come to after the little birds disappear, the little birds tweeting around your head when you're knocked unconscious. Maybe they'll come to realize that they can't just victimize each other. Maybe that's the key. But the bottom line is this: we're depending upon the virtue of our neighbors at this point. We really are. We're depending upon the fact that our neighbors, the people that are right down the street or right across the hallway, are going to behave in decent ways when there's not enough to go around. That's the practical reality of it. If you live in a community where you feel like people have a lot of virtue, God bless you. You're a lucky motherfucker because there's a good chance you're gonna, well, there's a good chance you'll do better than most. No, it'll be hard for everybody, but it'll be less difficult for those who are not surrounded by enemies. But ultimately, if you live in a community that has no sense of community, where basically the only way people connect is through Facebook, like I said, folks, it's the virtue that's going to be your ultimate defense. How much do you believe your neighbors, your friends, your family are people of virtue? Are they the people that would play a game and say, "Oh no, you have to go back a move and give me my fucking aircraft carrier?" Or are they the kind of people who would honorably take their licks and move on? Because if they're the first type of person, then yeah, you're surrounded by people who will eat your dog first, but then they will eat you. And if you don't have a dog or a cat, they will skip directly to you. Anyways, I don't know if we want to talk about gato tacos or cat tacos, but being that this podcast is at about an hour, and we've discussed the fact that I live on the fifth floor and there's no elevator, so people will have to be really hungry to come eat this piece of choice meat, this cannabis-imbued hulk of monstrosity, this well-aged Kobe beef of cool. This well-baked Kobe beef of cool. Yeah. So for this Tuesday, September the 17th, 2019, remember, the power of super transcendental magic is in your fingertips, baby. Make today fantastic.